Hello and welcome to the Weird Things Podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Let's get started!
Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Oh, yeah.
Well, been a slow week in AI.
Said nobody ever.
Gravy. Let's go to picks. Let's just go straight to picks.
Good gravy. So where do we want to start?
I mean, I guess
we did Operator last week. That which feels like 10 years ago now.
Yes. So this last week, you know, DeepSeek's reasoning model, their R1 model, which was sort of their version of OpenAI's O1 model, hit. And it was crazy because over the weekend, it just gained momentum. And then people discovered the paper that we talked about a month ago.
Yeah.
About where the DeepSeek engineers did some really brilliant optimizations to basically, for one part of the training, and that's what gets really misconstrued, for one part of the training, for the final training, the R1 model did not use a tremendous amount of compute. It's like, you know, they claim about $5 million. A lot of skepticism around that, but I'm just taking things at face value, what was said. And did some great stuff. There was methods in there that I can now confirm were things that we were doing when I was in OpenAI, knew about internally, which was great for OpenAI, not great for the rest of the AI community, to be fair. But, you know, Mark Chen came out and said,
It sounds like there's a little bit of polite shading, but I don't know what the things are.
And let me clarify. Like, they did some wonderful, brilliant optimizations, as far as I know, were completely original DeepSeek. I want to make that very, very clear. And so, and like literally, you know, they had to work with the, you know, because of GPU export controls, they had to limit work with, you know, processors that had certain limitations. They figured out methods to be able to move data through that more efficiently, use compression. When it came time to train their reasoning model, you know, one of the things you can do is like every output you go and like evaluate it. They do what's kind of like a group output where you look for like, you know, how does something relate to the group and then measure it, kind of technical stuff. So there was a mix of really awesome hardware optimizations. Some of the stuff in the reasoning stuff was like the same sort of solutions that had been used to make O1 and that, you know, DeepSeek apparently came about them independently. And it's, you know, and again, it's, you know, OpenAI can say, yeah, we thought of this too. Well, cool, but now this method's out there for everybody else to use, and there's a big difference for it.
I have not been following this closely. Can I tell you as the story as I understand it, and you can correct the gaps that where I'm not getting it right. As I understand it, part of the weird iPhone versus Android part two thing that's going on is essentially DeepSeek made a splash for using very little compute, but it was built on the shoulders of OpenAI in an abusive way or in a terms.
Well,
of service?
No, let's separate. So okay. First off, we'll say like what we know. Okay, they released the model V3 last week, which was very competitive with GPT-4, an exceptional model and many across the board. Whatever, it has the usual CCP limitations on it, SATA, Tiananmen Square, all that. And there is this, you know, this was the model we showed when I asked it what its API was. It's a GPT-4 and would give you the actual markdown and stuff.
Were you sort of a kind of a zero day penetrator on that? Because it seems like they patched it after you had discovered that.
I would say yes. I've been that with a lot of stuff where I just kind of get, I'm curious about it. So what happened is V3 model comes out. And they legit did. And it's funny because I'm getting yelled at by people who are like this anti-AI open. Why are you hate everything? I'm like, I keep saying they do.
Why aren't you giving them the fair time of day, Andrew?
I know.
It's just so polite. So, they're just very nice, nice, polite people.
Yeah. I think there is a question of like data contamination, but that doesn't explain all the success of the model because other people trained on top of OpenAI stuff and whatever. And so, and again, I say that to them blue in the face. And I get people who I really liked and respected in the AI community who are like, my joke is like, it's like I acted like I just ran up and ripped the beard off the department store Santa Claus. It's creepy, it's not real. And I'm like, no, Christmas is cool. But you know, like legit, really great hardware optimizations. Other people have been replicating. So what it means is for certain parts of AI training, provided you have the data, that you can train these models faster and more efficiently. But we've been seeing these efficiencies since 2020. There was a paper put out by Anthropic, which said that, you know, they saw like a 1.8x speed up in compute efficiency every year, and it's probably 4x compute. We saw that. That's why we got Anthropic was able to make the Haiku model, was a much more efficient version of another model. That's why GPT-4o mini is available, because they took GPT-4 and figured out how to make it more efficient to this. Following that tradition and probably maybe pulling the future into the present is what the DeepSeek team did. And so I'm going to be very clear on that.
But part of the reason why, but part of the reason why it made such a splash, we talked about it a couple weeks ago, and I think we definitely talked about it last week. But all of a sudden, Monday, it became cause celebrity because it had big reverberations on Wall Street, and you saw big hits through a lot of the tech sector, specifically Microsoft and Nvidia, two of the companies that are at the forefront of AI development, and specifically the general concept that what has made AI breakthrough, what has created the jagged frontier as we know it now, is compute upon compute upon compute upon compute with brilliant engineering that is continuing to make it more and more efficient, but that there's no way around. You're just going to need chips on chips on chips on chips on chips. What the concept of DeepSeek, which I think is now pretty clearly, you know, sort of somewhere between wishful thinking and mass hysteria, was that DeepSeek had broken through on something fundamental to the point where you would not need the kind of chips and compute that the likes of OpenAI and Anthropic and Google have been insinuating that they are going to need to continue to bring about the future of this technology. I don't think that much has, that was, I think, the high point for that idea. I don't think there's been much evidence that has come out afterward to suggest that that is a serious notion now. Not to say that they have not done brilliant things, because this is a show that has been on this topic for a very long time. And so I think we have a realistic look at it. And I think realistically, like Andrew said, you could look at these efficiency gains that they had and say, this is great. This is a big leap forward in the medium, without saying you can now train a model on a toaster, which is essentially kind of what the reason why a lot of these stocks took a gigantic tumble.
Yeah, the way I look at it is, in one reaction, there's people who think that you just get to AGI and you're done. You just get to an AGI level model and you're done, not realizing that there's improvements in efficiency gains to be made there. So taking everything on the face value, let's say that Anthropic, so Dario Amodi, the head of Anthropic, who I used to work with OpenAI, released his own. I've got a very thoughtful post talking about, you know, where this fits into the scheme of things and, you know, what they did that was really significant over at DeepSeek. And the point he's made and other people are made, like, let's assume that's true. Let's say it's a 10x improvement. And that's really what it comes down to, because, like, they say they spent $5 million. Anthropic's like, well, for us to create Sonnet, we spent, you know, a couple tens of millions of it. So maybe they've spent $50 million. So let's say it's a 10x improvement. That's significant. What that means is, we get GPT-6 at GPT-5 prices. We get GPT-7 at GPT-6 prices. It doesn't mean we stop developing those scale models. It just means we're pulling them into the future sooner. And I would argue that it may mean the need for compute may go up actually even more, because these models use a lot of compute. When you go into DeepSeek or you go now into O3, which just launched today, and you say, think, it's continuously using tons of tokens to think about this thing. And so instead of just a model that's optimized to fit onto your laptop and give you an answer in 500 milliseconds, it's going to spend 6 seconds, 8 seconds and stuff. And so the amount of compute you're using for this just increases. So that was the interesting takeaway for me, was, man, I think Wall Street bet the wrong way, because we've now said people are very excited about a use that takes a lot more compute.
Yeah, and that's before you kind of get into the data side of it. And there are two kind of elements of it. One is the chip side, the other is the data side. We don't know exactly what the answer is on the chip side. We know what DeepSeek has said. We know that there are export controls on certain kinds of chips that can go there. There have been allegations that maybe they got chips from Singapore, that they are circumventing some of the export controls. We don't know, so let's just leave that where it is for now. The data seems a little bit more clear cut that they did not generate their own data. They did what a lot of models, bootstrapped models, had done.
Let me clarify. Let me be very fair. So like for the V, so there's two models involved, right? Yeah. Technically third. So you have the V3, which is like your GPT-4o scale model, right? Then you use that model to generate your chains of thought, your sequences of how to think through data to then train your R1 model. So there's an R1.0 model, which is basically used to generate this, and the R1 is trained on top of that. So the R1.0, you kind of think of it as sort of being built on top of like using, you know, outputs from their V3 model. The V3 model, that's the one that shows the fingerprints of like, hey, it looks like there's a lot of data, maybe have been API access tokens that went into it. Then they generated their own chains of thought, because the O1 from OpenAI, it will give you summaries of them. It'll give you, you can take the question, the answer, and the summary, but it doesn't give you the actual chains of thought. So they had to create their own.
Yeah.
Now, I've heard it argued that you can take that, fit that into a model like Claude, and say, I want you to simulate what these would actually look like and create chaining data. But either way, they did build their R1.0 model that did train this data, and they did train R1 off of that. There are what some people say are suspicious similarities between the policies that they both have between O1 and R1, that it looks like they may have taken a bunch of O1 outputs. Maybe that hasn't been proven. And you know, I want to be as fair to this as it is. And it's still the technical thing they did and what they were able to replicate is very significant, because, you know, whether or not it was 5 million total or they had $1 billion of GPUs, they still did very useful techniques that other people can build upon right now. And that is out there.
So what do we anticipate the next move somebody will make will be? I mean, obviously today it's OpenAI is releasing O3. I guess, do we just want to move on to O3?
Yeah, I think there's probably, I mean, the DeepSeek hysteria, I think is a watershed moment in the history of AI, because you now had a lot of people that were not tuned into a lot of these questions that now became tuned into a lot of these questions because it involved Wall Street, because now all of a sudden, you know, you're going to have the squawk box talking about compute and reasoning models and a lot of the verbiage that we've used on this show, you are now hearing in places that you didn't hear it before, because this fairly inside the world of AI conversation broke contain and really moved the needle in the market, the likes of which a few things have. So, or at least few things that aren't from established players have. That's, I think, a big deal. It is a big deal in kind of further cementing how much AI is a cornerstone here, because this was not, I mean, part of the flavor of this controversy was that like, oh, are all these companies being hosed? Is NVIDIA overcharging, and is NVIDIA driving up this scarcity because for profit? And now I think now that saner heads have kind of come to the table, it's like, no, you're still going to need a lot of chips. The AI community and Super Bowl Sunday, you're going to have to buy more chips than you think. Like, that is just the reality here. But still, it has turned on a bunch of people to these conversations. And that, I think, is very meaningful for the world of AI, because that's how these things become mainstream.
Yeah, part of the thing that happened was last week you had OpenAI announce their project Stargate. And Stargate was this effort, basically they want to build over a period of 5 years, $500 billion data complex, you know, or a system of data complexes to be able to train next generation models. And the thinking that, by the way, I mean, I am full confession playing with V03, the next OpenAI model right now.
Should I go ahead and open it up? Because we know how these episodes end is a new toy shows up and suddenly we're off to the races.
So I asked it to create a centipede-like game for me here. And this was just literally as I was talking to you. So they've announced this thing and people are like, oh, do you really need $500 billion, you know, of a compute system to do that? And the question comes into is, do we think that we're going to run out of our things to be able to compute? And we're going beyond the world of language models now. We're going into the world of using things like, you look at systems like VO2 and Sora that use a tremendous amount of compute to generate, you know, to simulate physics. Models can be used to power robotics and stuff. And so it was the Wall Street reaction of like, I guess we don't need as many computers is kind of like, you know, would be, you know, after Edison invents a more efficient light bulb, I guess we don't need a lot of electricity after all, you know, and this is a thing where we're going to watch, you know, you've heard a thing mentioned, but Jevons paradox with J-E-V-O-N, which basically says that, you know, the lower the price something becomes, the more we use it because we find more applications for it. This was what Andrew Carnegie did with steel. When he lowered the price of steel so much, you started doing things you never would have thought of, like building a bridge out of steel. Building a building out of steel, which would have just been an absurd idea. And now, you know, that and that with that came the whole idea of the skyscraper. And you have compute that is this powerful. And this really, I just won, guys. I want you to know.
This is, by the way, for everybody at home who wondered what those phone calls sound like where Sam Bankman-Fried was playing a game while he was doing an interview. You just heard it, my friends. Yeah, only at this level, Andrew Main wrote a program to simulate Centipede and then won the game while landing his point.
I will say it does make me slow down in my speech, so I'm not doing, you know, too many words per minute.
Yeah,
so.
No, there I mean, to be honest, maybe that's a good way to kind of to channel your extra thought cycles off to the side.
Yeah, so I did to round up the DeepSeek story. There is this question, and what it did show, many people. Was that Chinese labs that the ways towards powerful, you know, AI systems isn't through compute alone. And there had been this mentality that if we just cut off their chips, that's all we need to do. And I think we've talked about this here that, you know, there are clever people everywhere. And just because the Silicon Valley way was to build a tremendous amount of compute, raise billions of dollars and have your team focusing on just maximizing the compute isn't the only way that you can get there. So it was weird because when the paper for V3 came out last month, Andre Karpathy, who's, you know, brilliant AI researcher, had talked about it and pointed out like the great things they did. Everybody in the community like, oh wow, this is really cool. Like this is very cool. Sorry, folks, had to sneeze there. But it wasn't like, you know, the heads of Anthropic and OpenAI were like standing on top of this, their building, screaming at the clouds going, why? They're like, very interesting, very cool. Now we move forward. But there was the geopolitical aspect was people like, wait, China can build this stuff? It's like, you know, I worked in labs with a lot of Chinese Americans and Chinese born citizens who were pretty brilliant. And I don't think that anybody in the game was ever doubting the capability of Chinese researchers. And that DeepSeek put together an amazing team of people to do stuff wasn't shocking to me. You know, no. I think that the thing was we had seen some sort of like, sort of attempts before. And there is a huge part of what you hear about Chinese technical innovation is pushed by Chinese propaganda is often just BS. And I think we get so used to hearing the BS stuff like, oh, we have a 2-second battery. Oh, we solved fusion. Oh, we've done this. That we forget there's actually really amazing researchers there doing legit great work. Mm-hmm. And we saw that.
Yeah. It is silly to think that there isn't great, that there's not a very, very vibrant tech community that has done extraordinary work in China, especially in a field like AI, where relatively it's very fast moving and very agile. And there is a vibrant open source community. So while I do think that maybe sometimes they could maybe have a little bit more etiquette toward my friend Andrew Main on social media. I do think that that
I'm here for it. I'm okay. They threatened to kick me in the balls. It was funny.
My open source, I think open source is going to be a huge, huge, huge part of AI development. And when you really look at AI adoption widespread, it will not happen on the level that I think it probably should happen without the open source community. And then just to give you an AI feels good story that was on social media last night, I believe this was on ChatGPT, but there's no reason why this kind of stuff cannot be democratized forward. I believe it was on the free tier on OpenAI. But there was a parent who was worried about their children's teeth. And they'd gone to the dentist a bunch of times. You've heard stories like this in the past, but this is probably the most recent one. And it was just consistently reoccurring cavities. And the dentist just kind of kept blaming, like, well, you're not doing things right. You're not doing things right. Not only by describing what was happening, but then uploading the x-rays, there was a fairly rare condition that was happening with this young girl's mouth. And now she's going to be able to get better treatment from a dentist because she knows what to look for. And they're not just going to short circuit on, like, well, make sure that she brushes and flosses. This is the kind of stuff that happens when these technologies are put in people's hands at the cheapest possible price, which right now is free. So, like, we want that. We want that. And open source is a huge, huge, huge part of it. China is a part of it. What we don't want to do is just get over our skis and convince ourselves that things that are not real are real when there's so many miracles that are happening all around us.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about O3.
Yes.
And again, to reiterate, The reasoning models like O1, O3, and R1, they imagine kind of a special version of a GPT-4 scale model that you give it a problem. It then says, let me break this problem down into smaller problems. Let me figure out how I'm going to try to solve it and test myself along the way to see if this is a good solution. And then evaluate it and then give you my final answer. Instead of like a buzzer clock that says you've got to answer in 2 seconds, it can go off in a room with a scratch pad, try to come out. Imagine if I said, answer the question now versus here's a notepad, go work it out, come back to me. And that's how these reasoning models work effectively, is that they can use a process to do this. OpenAI launched the O1 model last year. And O1 was amazing because people kept waiting for GPT-5. And then we show this other model that is extremely capable, slower than traditional things, but just showed that we broke through all these barriers as far as high-level problem solving. And then before the end of the year, they announced O3. They went from O1 to O3 to avoid infringing on O2, the telephony network copyright. So they just said, we'll just go straight to O3. And O3 was significantly better, blew through certain benchmarks, and just showed that there was this really exciting path towards more and more intelligent models. And if they have O3, then you can assume they probably have even cooler stuff they're working on. And they found, that's when he started hearing people at OpenAI saying confidently, hey, we think we know how to get to AGI right now. And, it's one thing to say it. It's another thing to demonstrate it. But now we have the O3 model, which is not AGI. You're going to find mistakes with it. And this is O3 mini, which is basically taking the bigger O3 model and what we call distilling it down, which is effectively you take the big model, have it generate a ton of outputs, and then train on top of those. But O3 is also available in the API, so you can build it in your application. And by performance standards, O3 mini is very, very powerful, very, very much faster. And it's pennies on the dollar to what it costs to use O1.
Well, and let's say, hitting AGI will be an incredible moment that we're all going to hail. And yes, it will require a ridiculous massive amount of resources and energy to do it. And 10 years from now, we will laugh at how much resources it took. But that's the way to go. Hey, I just made a game. How do I run this script?
So what you can do is go to CodePen, go to codepen.com or .io.
Okay, but I should copy this.
Oh, what did you write the script in?
Well, I don't know. Python, I guess. Yeah, it looks like Python.
Oh, you wrote it in Python. So you would need to, do you have like an IDE, like VS Code or something on your computer? Or?
That's a little bit above my current skill level.
Okay. So,
it says here, copy the code into a Python file and run it on your terminal. I need to have something to play Python. Oh, here, I'll just tell it to make it again in JavaScript.
Yeah, do that. Do that. Make and then you'll run it in CodePen.
Again in JavaScript. By the way, the prompts for anybody at home listening to audio, while everybody was talking, I typed, make a side-scrolling game, but it's on a Mobius strip. And I did a bunch of things, and it figured it out some stuff. And I said, how do I play it? And it's like, I said, can I play it now? And then I said, write an extremely primitive version of it that I could play here. And it seems to have, and it wrote it in Python. I said, make it again in JavaScript. And now I'm copying what it said. And where am I going, Andrew?
Go to codepen.io.
Oh, I accidentally, oh, code pen. Great. Yeah. There we go. And all right. And do I need to log in or just
start? It should say on the left, you should see a thing that says start coding.
There we go. Okay. I started coding and I'm going to paste all this in JavaScript and then I'm going to hit what? Executor.
Is it JavaScript or is it like a single page thing with the HTML and the JavaScript inside? Yeah, or?
Well, the options are there's a little area that says HTML.
No, what did you get your output? What was your output?
It looks like an HTML. It says doc type.
Okay, HTML. Just paste it into the HTML part. Just paste the whole thing in there.
Okay,
there we go. It'll play and be like, oh, you're supposed to.
Okay, and then what? Oh, got it. Press enter to move, type jump. Oh my gosh. Jump.
Jump. Everybody.
I jumped
jump,
over
jump.
An obstacle, it says. boy, it was not kidding when it said extremely extremely primitive.
Yeah.
Jump. I'm literally hitting enter to go forward. My little letter P is getting up to an X. P is player, X is obstacle, and I'm jumping. I wonder where the Mobius part of it is. Oh, and it just keeps on going. That's the Mobius strip. Okay. So now I'm just going to tell it, make it more interesting. Make it more fun. There we go.
So I'll share with you a version I made. This was the first thing I made. I showed you, I have my little tool for creating images. Mm-hmm. And I have done zero iteration on this. Let me make this very, very clear. I just told it how to create an image and it created my knight.
Wow.
Right. And I could jump and
wait, did you do this just now?
I did this earlier while we were talking. It was the first thing I made. But then I use this thing that basically I have a little image generator that just does it from URLs. So then I said, okay, I want you to, you know, simplify it. Let's just use blocks. So let me hold on, let me get the right one. I created another version, which I said, okay, just simplify it with blocks. And I've got the logic and it will jump up and then I can go here and it will actually go to, ready for this, another level.
Oh, that's amazing.
And I could replace that with actual GIFs or whatever, but the logic is there. So like that's kind of cool.
By the way, I just made my game called Mobius Runner. Yeah, I don't know if we're in competition or anything. Press space to jump. Oh, there we go.
Look at that.
I hit an obstacle. Game over. Here, let me see if I can.
Share it.
Is it not showing up for you?
No. I mean, I took over the screen, so let me stop doing that so you can.
Yeah. So it says press space to jump. Watch out. Every so often there we go. Okay. There we go. And let me see if I can jump. Yay. Hey, look at this. So every few loops, the controls flip. I guess that's the nod to the Mobiusness of it. And then Now, I don't know what the controls would flip. I hit an obstacle, game over. You know what? I'm going to ask it to refine it. And I'll say, I guess I'm just going to give it the command.
Okay. So
make it controversial.
Let me give some background to our audience here, too. Is it what we're doing right now, I encourage everybody to try, play, and iterate. And we're going to get to a point where you're going to be able to build Grand Theft Auto 10 like this. And it sounds absurd, but you're going, we would work with a bunch of friends and say, let's create a big game. We've just, you know, you remember when 3 years ago I was showing, you know, the first output from these code models and making very simple games. And it would take me a lot of prompting to figure out how to get it right, you know, to get it like, you know, create a Zelda-like game in six lines of, you know, whatever. Now we're at this point where, you know, chimpanzees like Brian can just, you know, keep at it and eventually get, you know.
Hey guys, hold on. I want to show you my new game, Controversial Mobius Runner. The system got me. Game over. Conformity is the jailer of freedom. Okay, here we go. And let's do this. Okay, let's see. Press space to jump. Oh no, question everything. What's this? In this game, every loop questions the system. Conformity is the jailer of the system. Okay, well, I would like this to, there we go. Let's see. Oh, I can't jump. Oh, there we go. The system got me. All right. I'm going to have to make it also easier or make it better. That's all I'm saying.
That's fine. Sometimes all it takes. We're at this cool stage too, where the more we iterate on these things, the better they get. And you know, it's very, very exciting to think about the fact that we're measuring this in months.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try.
All right, boys. Unfortunately, I have to bow out here for childcare reasons, but I will see you later.
You got it. All right. Don't forget that conformity is the jailer of freedom.
See ya.
That's what this video game just told me.
I'm working on I got it to generate stuff in A-frame VR.
What is A-frame VR?
A-frame is an HTML framework. Oh, Brian, why not just ask it to create something in A-frame VR and find out?
Okay, sure. Is this something I could do?
Yeah, tell it use A-frame VR to create.
I'll say adapt this for
just start over. Don't just tell it to do something new. Like that's, you don't want to get too,
got it. You want a fresh start. So let's do this.
Yeah. So I'm going to share with you, I gave it a simple instruction to create a Minecraft style castle.
A-frame VR. Is it just A-F-R-A-M-E?
Yeah. Just tell it A-frame, you know? Yeah. Here, let me share with you my screen. I just had it build this.
Oh my God. And so that's you playing it right now?
Yeah, it's me moving through it right now. So
that's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, there you go. It says creating it. Now, how do I get it to execute this? I got
paste code. It. Go back to CodePen, paste it in.
Really? Get out. CodePen, select all, paste. And, well, I don't know what I did, but I definitely made a square and stuff. Oh, yep. And now I'm moving around. Okay.
Yep, that's the A-frame sort of default thing is those objects. So anyhow.
Okay. That's remarkable.
All right. I'm going to create a, it's sometimes interesting to see how it solves it. I want to create an HTML virtual planetarium that looks really cool. Really cool. Okay. So one of the things that's neat here is that you and I, Brian and I, are just playing out as we're like termites that haven't even, we're like chimpanzees that have discovered sticks haven't realized that we should be using them to shove them into the termite mound. We're just like doing lightsaber fights.
Yep.
But there will be people who will figure out that they're good for termite mounds and other things, et cetera.
And before we go too far forward, we should point out that, you know, when you're talking about GTA 10 or whatever, you and your friends can create, man, is that true? And in fact, as with so many other things, Ray Kurzweil talks about that idea in The Singularity Is Nearer. He says, look, the next great epic is already in somebody's mind, and the entire movie can come out just with him holding it in his mind, telling a computer this, no, now more of this, now like that, now more like this. And then eventually what comes out is just an entire feature length movie.
Yeah. And I think that all those things will be possible, but I also think that we're going to realize that the best stuff is still going to be collaborative things. I hear a lot of people in AI like, oh, it'll be a movie customized for you. Like, well, what'd you make here, Brian?
Oh, I made instead of those regular primitives, I said, make them trees that grow eyeballs that weep diamonds. And so I'm just going to, right now it's fairly low fidelity of audio listeners. It's pretty much, it looks like three matchsticks. So now what I'm going to do is I'm just going to punch it up. You know, I'm going to give helpful notes like higher fidelity, please.
Brian has mastered the art of, you know, just saying, make it better. More of this.
We talked about that short that I saw where the opening scene is a girl asked for a thing, and it says, oh, I can't do that. And she says, please. And it says, okay, doing it. And then she's about to leave, but then says, thank you. And then smash cut to Terminator 2 future, the, you know, and their robots are about to get her. And they were like, not this one. She was kind. All right. So.
I think I've talked to a number of people who've been frustrated with the idea that they've been challenged by just the constant tempo of new news, of like all the news is coming through one by one by one. And it's just a little bit like, when does it slow down? And the answer is probably never.
So in this case, I wrote higher fidelity, please. And you could tell it's got much more advanced. You could tell it's got a gloss polish on the eyeballs at the top. And now the matchsticks are a matte finish. The lighting is still very East German. So I'm going to say now my helpful note will be add bloodshot eyeball maps to the eyes. I'll say bitmaps so that it doesn't think I'm talking about cartography. That's another thing, is that as long as it understands the way you speak, then it's it can work with you.
Yeah, and there, we went from a point where prompt engineering meaning having to be very sophisticated and using just the right words to now, as you've talked about, we have to think that you're a manager giving specific instructions about what you want, what you don't want. And
okay, so in this case, it's just not working.
Very interesting inflection point. So where does this go from here? One of the things that's cool with reasoning models is they can generate a ton of output and a lot of data. And if we want to start applying these things to robotics, everything's happening faster. Like everything is just going to accelerate to the point where we're going to find it a lot easier to make tools. And, you know, we did this, you know, with weird things where, you know, we wanted to shorten the amount of time it took us to take something and get it uploaded. And using AI powered code tools, we built a thing that built summarizers, did the images, did a lot of work that would have been 45 minutes of work, and then did it in a few minutes. And I should probably revisit that code because I think it'd make it a lot faster. Of course, the biggest bottleneck was mine and Brian's attention span.
And yeah, and legitimately our time. That's the other thing, is like, you know, subjectively, it feels as though the days are getting shorter because there's less and less that we could get done. But I certainly still am waking up at 5:30 every morning and going to bed and immediately getting up and doing it all again. Actually I'll save that for after things, but, okay. Interesting. So it looks like it's still loading here. I don't know if that didn't work. Oh, maybe no. Well, I guess I will go ahead and share the thing. Played a game. Well, what one thing that ChatGPT is absolutely supreme on is giving suggestions of what other people seem to want. And if for nothing else, an exercise that I think really all you're doing is looking in the mirror with a little bit of digital help. But if you've gotten to a place where in your prompts, your assistant knows give or take who you are, or, you know, if not, you could just cue it by saying, I am a blank aged blank who does blank. I am this level of what, and then just ask it, how many people do I have contact with, or how many people know about me? And then say, what do they want? Given everything I've done up until this, what is a project I could start that everyone would think, of course, that's the natural next step? And then you get some really interesting answers, even though it's trained on you explaining yourself to it. Then you ask it, what do other people expect? Or what is something that everybody would be like, of course they would. And I got some really interesting answers that have deeply informed my next big project.
Can you tell a little more about that?
Yeah. Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, if you want, I can go ahead and share. This is all kind of speculative right now, but I can share the beginning of it. I started off asking, and I don't know how much of this is leaning on the fact that I happen to be a, you know, semi-public figure. But I wrote, tell me about the demographic who's familiar with Brian Brushwood. And by the way, this is GPT 4.0. This is not even the 0.3 reasoning. And it exactly nailed it. It said demographic.
Convicts.
Yeah. It said demographic familiar with Brian Brushwood falls into a few key groups. One, magic and skepticism enthusiasts, fans of Scam School, now Scam Nation, Hacking the System, and live magic performances. They like sleight of hand tricks, bar bets, and cons. They're skeptically minded, into rational thinking, and adjacent to communities like the Amazing Randy Skeptic Movement. Two, tech-savvy internet culture followers. These are the early adopters of podcasting culture and YouTube. They're likely familiar with Brian from Modern Rogue, Cord Killers, and Weird Things. They're fans of digital content creation, life hacks, curiosity-driven content. They're more likely to be active on Reddit, Twitter, and Discord. Three, comedy and nerd subculture fans, listeners of Great Night, formerly Night Attack. They're fans of offbeat humor, improv-style podcasting, and Brian's collaborations with Justin Robert Young. They're often crossover fans of
Baby Live Show. Okay, okay.
All right, anyway. But they point is they exactly got it all right. In fact, I don't even know that I've publicly talked about becoming a Wizard of Ads partner that does marketing strategy for folks. But but I guess the world knows about it, and so as a result, it picked it up and it gave the demographic breakdown right down to the age.
So this is sorry to interrupt this, but this is like if you'd gone out and you'd hired a consultant. And you said they gave you this, you'd be pretty happy.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Used to be that this alone was thousands of dollars. Right. And so then it says, does this match your expectations? Are you looking for a more refined breakdown? Like that wasn't enough. So I said, this is excellent. I'm creating a new project and this conversation will inform what I create. Let's start by finding out how many people I can reach and of what variety, split into three categories. And what I really meant was like, are you on the fringes, a casual or a hardcore, et cetera? Roughly how many humans can Brian reach? And it basically said prospects, you know, frenzy people, individuals who have a passing familiarity with Brian's work, but are not regular consumers. It just kicked back all my social media reaches, right? Two, casuals, those who occasionally engage with Brian's content across Scam Nation, Modern Rogue, Great Night, et cetera, podcasts, et cetera. And then it says estimating numbers. And I didn't really care what the numbers were. I just wanted it to kind of have a sense of what I was working with. And then I prompted it saying, I'd like to start a new video podcast live stream series and leverage all of my current projects into it. Fans of everything that came before should think, of course, Brian would do this. This is perfect. I can't wait to dive in. There should be a daily live stream, videos and audio podcasts and shorts. Describe what that might look like and what it might be about. And so it came up with something called the Infinite Heist tagline. The game is everywhere. Hmm. The only way to win is to play. And it basically came up with all this stuff. It wasn't bad. And so I said, I love the structure of this. Let's see if we can tweak the narrative focus. I've spent 10 years playing the Scoundrel Scam School, 10 years playing the Warrior, blowing stuff up and learning weapon stuff on Mono Rogue. And now that I've turned 50, I told the audience I'd like to work more on being the gentleman. That's the narrative positioning to expand the Modern Rogue brand. Really, I'd like to make the Modern Rogue and Scam Nation channels a Brian Brushwood mega brand. Pitch me another idea in the same vein as above. So he came up with something called the Grandmaster Play. Master the game, shape the world. This is about elevating the art of being a rogue.
Okay, I'm going to cut.
Yeah, go for it.
This is very cool. This is very cool and exciting. And so I would say that my takeaway, my question for you is, I apologize for cutting you off on that.
I'm just letting the audio listeners.
It's exciting. It's exciting. It's absolutely exciting to see this stuff because, you know, you and I are guys that spend so much time in our heads trying to think things through. And often what we want is just some signal, you know, and to understand a pathway. And I think that's what's great about this is that we have these tools now that can reflect part of our thinking, but give us some sort of direction. How would you, and this is more of an afterthings thing, but I'll give three tips for people on how to use these things to think about it. And then I'll give you time to think about three for you. Do you want to do that?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, one of these things is like, I had a question the other day because I was talking about somebody about a certain aspect of financial planning. And I know I'm completely ignorant when it comes to financial planning. And then, you know, I was able to go into a reasoning model and say, hey, here's my situation. What do you think I should do? And it's always like, hey, talk to a professional. It's like, cool, but give me some guide points. And so number one, I think financial planning is just a super great way to use these systems. Tell your situation, tell you what you're thinking about, telling you what you're doing. And it can explain things to you that another person might never even think to tell you. We saw that with that example before Justin mentioned with the parent dealing with the child that was having chronic cavities. You know, it turned out that they had some condition that was causing grooves in their teeth that you could see on the x-ray, but no dentist told them. It didn't necessarily mean, hey, we have a cure, but it's a different option. So I'd say number one is financial planning. Another thing is to think about, we are all going to have to learn and keep learning and adapt if we want to be very relevant. And to me, that's exciting and terrifying at the same time. But you can go into a thing and say, hey, I'm a graphic designer. By the way, these are my hobbies. This is what I'm interested in. Help me plan out what I should be looking at, be interested, et cetera. Can you do that for me? Okay. A third thing I found, now that we have these systems have search tools, you can go in and say, hey, can you find me jobs related to this, into this area or this city or this place that I want to live? And it will go look for stuff. It will find, you know, access to stuff and do that. And I think that these things are really, I've seen people use it for real estate. And I just think that we have to go beyond just traditional search and to go into like thinking search. So my three suggestions are one, start asking it financial questions. Obviously verify if somebody knows what they're doing. Number two, when it comes to education and career planning, use these models to think about what can I do here. Third, I'll actually steal from Brian and say business planning, like help me think about a good strategy for what I should do here. Like what are my, and if it gives you one good idea, worth it.
So one of the neat things that is built into these kind of bots are, and again, it doesn't, even if the knowledge base never gets better than it is right now, that's still enough for you to do truly incredible, miraculous things. If for no other reason than because you can get a perspective outside of your own. So in this case, what I was doing is, hey, I think a lot about how I see the world. I don't think too much about what the world wants from me. And I think of it in terms of sort of like, you know, life is an open book test. You can ask the audience for the answers if you ask elegantly enough. But in the case of a chatbot of ChatGPT, you don't even have to ask elegantly. You just say, hey, what does it look like everyone wants? And you're like, okay, well, I don't want to do that, but here's what I do want. What's a step in that direction, or what's likely to work, or what have you? So use it to hold a mirror up to yourself. The second thing is, any time you hear or encounter anything, ask questions like a toddler, a child. Because if you do this to other humans, once you become an adult, it is infinitely fatiguing on your relationships and your friendships to talk and ask questions like a toddler. Guess who has infinite patience for your nonsense questions? And my goodness, does the world look different when anything like, here, I'll do it right now. You start a new thread here under, I guess I'll do 3 mini. So I'm going to ask a silly question. Why do playing cards have round edges? This is something that, I mean, I don't know, I'd probably ask you or Justin, but the very act of asking you would be draining on you. They have rounded edges primarily to improve durability and handling. And we could say, what if they had double pointed edges on all corners? What could you do with them that you can't do now? And so that is I didn't even know where that question was going to come from in my mind, and then already it says double pointed corners on playing cards might improve fanning or stacking, and you can watch it clarifying. I love the fact that this new model reports on itself, and it instantly took it to cardistry skills, I guess because it knows I'm a magician. Innovative handling, interlocking, there you go. Make up a magic trick that uses this method. At any rate, so see the world like a toddler. And then finally, engage in role play. So this is a weird one. I wanted to know the history of cargo cults, and it must have given a Wikipedia style synopsis 3 or 4 times, but every time it was done, I couldn't really remember the specifics. Like, was it 20th century or 19th century, or was the island Fiji, or was it whatever? And I said, look, I need to lock this in my mind, which means repetition. Do me a favor. I want you to pretend to be a villager from this place. I want you to use the names of the local places a lot. And so as a result, a vivid image came up, and this native walked up to me and said, hey, welcome to Vanuatu Island. And I'm like, where are we? And he's like, yeah, Fiji's over there, whatever. I'm like, tell me about what happened. He's like, one day these sky birds came down from the sky and land down, and we got cargo. What's cargo? Oh, it's wicked awesome stuff. Anyway, very quickly, all of this stopped being a summarized Wikipedia book report, and it now lives in my memory very flatly and simply what the story of cargo cults are.
Yeah. And it's like, I'm playing with something in the background here where we just see that, like, we're getting the ability to build educational tools, et cetera. I was excited, you know, years ago there was, you know, HyperCard, which was a thing on the Mac that was a really powerful tool that made it so non-coders could create things like educational games. The version of Myst that we know about, you know, Myst was based upon, originally was a HyperCard stack. And so I just fed this a simple prompt, which I'll share. I have a thing that generates, like I said, I have a URL that just generates images, and I asked it to make an explainer for radio telescopes. And
wait, you just typed make an explainer for radio telescopes?
Yeah, I gave it, my prompt was, I want to create explainers that are scrollable in HTML that explain the topic, image, text, etc. I think it was a strip. And then I gave it, I have a URL I use to create images. And so I just gave it that URL to generate. So it's basically just a URL with an image prompt that will generate or find an image for that. And so it made this as we're talking.
That is incredible.
Yeah.
The steel example that you gave of like make steel so cheap that people start doing things that you didn't know you would need steel for.
Yeah. I like this was while you're, it took me, you know, while you're the speaking, you know, I just built this, like, this is just, I went in and said, can you make this thing? And I can add more slides and stuff. I could take my own, text and put that in there. You know, like, let me, my favorite one to ask for is, you know, do 10 slides on memory palaces.
By the way, I asked the question, who are two celebrities that might be surprised to find out that they're related? And it's just going all the way down the rabbit hole. Look at this, piecing together connections. It's following threads with Ryan Reynolds, Chris Pratt and Cher. Then it moves forward. And it's like maybe Elvis and Julia Roberts, Shaquille O'Neal, and it says Benedict Cumberbatch turns out to be a distant relative of Winston Churchill, a connection that links a modern screen. Does Benedict know this? Then you failed. Interesting. It says there's no public record indicating that Benedict Cumberbatch has ever discussed or acknowledged this distant familial connection. Huh. Anyway. Well, you know what? Actually, let me ask this. Here's one I didn't know. Where my own last name? Where did the surname Brushwood originate? So I don't know if it's actually, it says appears to be of English origin, generally thought to be a topographic name from brush and wood. Yes, that's correct. Anyway, that's interesting.
So I'll share. I have a tool that also like will look for images on the web and just insert them. It's just like, again, it's a URL based thing. And so this one found an image to put it in there, found another image, and then generated this image and then did this. But this is just all.
Wow. And this
all is made while we're talking.
Well, and so this is what you told O3 to use the tools that you had.
Just literally use my URL to create or find an image and then just write the rest of this.
Wow. I need your URL. Can you share your URL or will that get expensive to you?
At some point I will share it publicly. Just right now it's like limited.
You don't want it to blow up. Yeah.
Yeah. But I will happily share it with you. Again, I want to be able to.
Yeah.
And so I will.
Yeah, that's so crazy. All right. You got any picks?
Yeah, my pick is right now Severance. Man, I want to compare and contrast. So I enjoy Silo, but I wish TV writers, I may quit AI and everything to go teach a course at Northwestern, which is season two shouldn't be a season long side quest.
Oh, is that what's happening on Severance?
Silo. Silo, that's happening.
I don't know. I'm halfway. Well, Silo does have certain, well, I don't know. You could always rewrite and work around it, but I don't know. I'm really getting to know, enjoying getting to know, what's his name? Steve Zahn's character, and that little pocket story, but I do agree. That's
pocket story though. Like we're 6 or 7, we're 7 episodes in with a slight spoiler. Why didn't he just replace the glass? Like I'm watching.
Oh, I haven't gotten that far yet, but
no. For the problem she's trying to solve that we saw in the first episode.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Interesting. Oh, yeah. No. She tore apart the suit, right? Is that what we're
talking? Watched her do every single solution problem solving thing except just try to fix the thing. It was like Batman versus Superman, Lois Lane throwing the kryptonite rod into the staff or the staff into the water so she could have something to do in the last act, which was to go find the rod she threw away. I'm enjoying the world, but like Severance is my pick. Severance has been great. I've been loving Severance. Like I absolutely adore that show.
Yeah, it's way, way good. And I guess we're only two episodes in. I guess maybe we'll save spoilery talk on Severance, but did you see, I guess it's been a week, so we wouldn't have chatted about it. They do a lot of that technical stuff where it's kind of a stunt, possibly just for the stunt's sake. But like, there's a unbroken sequence in episode one of season two, where Mark S. comes out of the elevator, walks around, looks left, looks right. And then, it's very tense. And then the elevator opens and out comes Dylan and the two of them are talking and then they're about to leave. And then the elevator opens and there's Irv. And then finally pause, look back. And then Heli comes out and then, immediately they released. So, you know, of course it was all done on purpose specifically for the fan, chatter generation. But, in episode two of season two, they have an unbroken scene where all of the Audis go back to work. And if you line the two up second for second, you can see them get into the elevator as an Audi and come out seconds later as an innie. The two scenes are perfectly matched up. And that is something that you could have enjoyed without ever knowing was a stunt and a flex, but I'm happier for getting to admire the stunt and the flex.
Andrew raises his hand. I realized they did the continuous shot in the first one. Did not realize they did it for the second one.
Right? I doff my cap to you, right? If you look at them side by side, you just, you know, type keywords for that.
Yeah. Yeah. Great stuff. I think we're in a really amazing time for content.
Yeah, dude. You know what? I'm going to double down on Severance as well.
Brian?
Mm.
It's been really weird.